Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to another meeting of the Michael Saylor Appreciation Society. Our special guest today is Michael Saylor himself, fresh from the Bitcoin for Corporations conference, in which he promoted Bitcoin to corporate America in very, very strong, made a very strong case for Bitcoin, why it matters for corporations and why it matters for corporate balance sheets. We've had Michael on before, and we spoke about his ideas on Bitcoin and his ideas on inflation and cost of living. And he's been an absolute thunderball of inspiration and powerful ideas since coming into the Bitcoin space over the last year. And it's an absolute pleasure to have him back again. Thank you very much for coming back, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
I guess we'll start with talking about the Bitcoin for Corporations conference. So what were your impressions of the corporations take? Did they buy your pitch? Clearly some of them did, Tesla namely, but what was the general impression you had?
My impression was, I was surprised at how much enthusiasm there is. You know, when we started in August, we were the first public company to make a serious commitment, and then Square followed us. And then Marathon Patent did a pretty big Bitcoin acquisition for their balance sheet a few weeks ago, $150 million. And then when Tesla did it, you know, we've now got four public companies in a row that have all made pretty material commitments. Of course, the market's been enthusiastic. The market's, you know, generally the market's been very supportive of all the Bitcoin companies. If you look at Square stock, PayPal stock, Riot Blockchain stock, Marathon stock, MicroStrategy has been well treated. I think Tesla, of course, is the most successful, you know, stock of the year. We've checked off one question, which was how will public shareholders view this? And there was some trepidation. And in fact, they've viewed it enthusiastically. For example, since Marathon did their $150 million Bitcoin acquisition, their stock doubled. If you're wondering how the public shareholders will view it, oftentimes the thing that holds back public companies from doing something is they're concerned about how it will be perceived by their outside shareholders. And because it's very difficult to meet with outside shareholders, they're changing every minute of the day between 9:30 and 4 p.m., right? Your shareholder base is changing. So it's like trying to grab onto a whirlpool in the middle of an ocean. You can't quite get your hands around it. It's dynamic. That's a challenge. But as we came in the conference, I thought, first of all, there's a lot of demand bubbling up. We had a lot of people asking us. A lot of people asking us, how'd you do this? What should we do? There's legal issues, regulatory issues. You know, will you trip the 40 Act? Are you going to be an ETF? What's the accounting treatment for it? What appropriate corporate governance? You know, rather than try to have one meeting at a time, you know, Saifedean, you realize at some point, if you had 40 hours of meetings a week for the next 30 years, well, that's like 2,000 times 30, right? What is that, 6,000? You can touch 6,000 people in 30 years. You just can't go fast enough. So you can't do these one at a time. So we thought, let's just go ahead and add it as a track to MicroStrategy World, which was all virtual. And I thought, by the way, MicroStrategy World last year was 2,500 of our customers in a room. It cost us $4 million and it cost them probably another $6 million. So we spent $10 million in 2019 to put 2,500 customers into a convention center. This year, MicroStrategy World, we probably spent 1/15th that much money. Our customers spent nothing. So we spent probably 1/30th. We reduced our travel and entertainment and event budget by 97%. By the way, we reduced all of our travel and events budget by 98% year over year, if you want an interesting factoid, 98%. So MicroStrategy World was pulled off for 97% less money. We had 21,000 people registered instead of 2,500. We thought we'll tack on Bitcoin for Corporations as an afterthought. I thought, well, if we get 800, that would be good. Then I thought, well, we'll probably get 1,000. Then I thought, well, we get 2,000. And I went on television and I said, well, I think we'll get 2,000. And then we had this surge. And the day of the event, no joke, it broke the internet. Like it actually broke our video server. And the stress was we blew through 15,000 people. And I was on the phone with my IT people saying, you know, get more capacity, you know, from our vendor. And for like an hour or 2 hours, we actually were in the morning leading up to the noon thing. We were like maxed out and I was worried. So some enterprising cyber hornets, I love the Bitcoiners. They're so enterprising. While I'm trying to solve the problem the conventional way, someone turns on live streaming to YouTube and they set up bootleg live streaming channels that have thousands of people on them. When we finally got to the noon session with Ross, but who you introduced me to, by the way, I think, thank you. So we got to the noon session with Ross and we had 8,500 people come into that session. So I thought I'd have 2,000 and we went to 8,500. I thought I'd have 1,500 companies represented and it was actually 7,000 companies represented in the live session. And then the live session got bootlegged out and posted on YouTube, went viral. I think we're up to about 250,000 views now. So I guess the summary would be exceeded my expectations. And we had people from SpaceX there. We had people, you know, some of Elon Musk companies. We had people from Marathon there. The ones you would expect were there. But of course, there's an avalanche of private companies, and there were a decent number of public companies and treasurers and CFOs that were lurking. Some don't want to have their names mentioned, as you can imagine, because it's a sensitive topic, right? It's material for a company. But I think we can call it a success because on television for the past few days, we've had the CEO of GM asked if they're going to invest in Bitcoin. We've had the CFO of Twitter asked about Bitcoin. We've had the CEO of Uber asked about Bitcoin. You know, we just had the mayor of Miami, Francis Suarez, announce that they're moving forward to put Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And it's become part of the conversation, even to the extent that now people are grappling with the accounting and the volatility issues, which I account to be an incredible success for all of us, right? Because a year ago, no one would have even discussed this. This morning, we had a milestone in the CFO section of the Wall Street Journal. The challenges of incorporating Bitcoin on the balance sheet for CFOs was discussed in an article. And I think that's the first time that the Wall Street Journal and the CFO section had ever actually brought up the topic of Bitcoin. So the implication is it's in the conversation everywhere. And increasingly, people have to come to terms with why they're not doing it. And there'll be technical reasons. Oh, it's volatile, right? I mean, it's going up 200% a year, but it's going up. It's making us large sums of money in a volatile fashion. That's a technical reason. But if you're an investor and your reason for not investing in something is it's making money too fast in an unpredictable fashion, I'm not even going to say what I think of that. It's quite amusing to me. But if I had to be criticized, I think I'd like to be criticized for making money too fast in a unpredictable fashion. And then they're grappling with the accounting issues, because if you hold it as the underlying asset, it's currently accounted for as an intangible on the balance sheet, which is the most conservative way. I kind of like the way you'd account for patents or things like that. You know, if you hold it as a fund, then it may, under certain circumstances, be accounted for as an investment asset. But then if you have a fund, it's a security. And if you hold the asset, it's property and a commodity. And if you have a lot of securities, at some point you might trip the SEC 40 Act and become a finance company because you have more than 40% of your assets as securities. There are a lot of nuances and people are grappling with them, but they're good debates, right? Good discussions to be having right now. And a year ago, no one would have even considered these matters. And so we have injected this into the conversation, I think, around the world. And I think the Bitcoin conference was part of it. Clearly, the Tesla purchase was helpful. And I think February 8th, you could call mainstream day, Saifedean. February 8th this year was the date when the entire story of Bitcoin as a treasury reserve asset crossed outside of the Bitcoin and the crypto community. And it was in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Irish News, the Straits Times, every major financial publication, everywhere in the world, and all the mainstream media. I got invited the next day to go on CNBC, Bloomberg, Fox, CNN, NPR. And I'm like, no more. I can't do any more. But the point is CNN, NPR, these are not, you know, Bitcoin journals. These are mainstream sources. So I think the message is exploding into the mainstream. You could start the clock. You know, February 8th was the day the shot was heard around the world. And that combined with the Bitcoin for Corporations summit placed this in the public domain. The beauty now, of course, is I used to meet with 100 people and I could meet with 10 a week. And then we met with 8,000 people. And then it went viral to 250,000 people. And now we published our Bitcoin playbook. And that's out there circulating amongst lawyers and accountants and advisors and investors. And we just let that percolate. And I think good things will happen.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now. Absolutely. I was going to say the exact thing that you mentioned, which is 1 year ago, none of this was going on anywhere. Nobody was talking about any of this stuff. I remember exactly it was 1 year ago. I was at a conference and I was with somebody who works in a Bitcoin company, and I was telling them, they were talking about some blockchain nonsense, and I was telling them that the case for corporations really is hold a small part of your balance sheet in Bitcoin, and especially if you're operating internationally, it'll help you to get around banking closures, and it'll protect you from inflation. And also, the response that I used to get when I mentioned this to people was always, no, it's too volatile, and the accounting would be too much of a headache. There's no way anybody would do it. And it's incredible, and it's almost entirely down to you how the conversation has entirely shifted in a year now, to the point where we have a complete playbook that, you know, the lawyers and the accountants can just go to microstrategy.com, download your corporate playbook, and they have the complete guide to how they need to answer those questions. And we've already had thousands of them show up. So I think I can't but commend you on your incredible service to the cause and this unbelievable contribution of just putting this out there and forcing it upon people. And it's people call it speculation and people say, well, people are just speculating. But I think ultimately every economic decision is speculation. And maybe the reason this speculation is paying off is because it is a better economic decision. Maybe it's just that it's a better asset on the balance sheet and the world is discovering that.
Yeah, I mean, words can be prejudicial. As we talked about before, you know, if I kicked you into the ocean and I threw a life preserver in next or life raft next to you, it wouldn't be a speculation to put on the life vest, you know, the life vest or crawl onto the life raft. If you were walking through the desert and about to drown and I dropped a water bottle that was sealed from a brand that you'd never purchased in a supermarket before, it wouldn't be a speculation to crack open the water bottle and drink the water. And if you lived in Argentina and the currency was crashing and you had pesos and you had the opportunity to buy a tangible asset or convert your money to dollars, I don't think it would be a speculation. I think it would be rational, right? Like, you know, if I kicked you out of an airplane and you had a parachute, it wouldn't be a speculation to pull the ripcord either. I mean, it's just, you know, it's only speculation when you don't understand the engineering or the science behind the thing. Then it's speculation. Yeah. You could say it was speculation for Amazon to use the internet to sell books.
And it's speculation for people to buy Amazon stock as well, but it works.
15,000 retail companies got destroyed for their lack of speculation. Hey, can we talk about the Fiat Standard?
Absolutely, yes.
So a couple of thoughts I had. You made this point. You said we're talking about money progressing from soft to hard. The gold standard was the culmination of commodity monies, you know, from glass beads and seashells and stone coins and the like, and copper and brass. And eventually we get to gold, and gold is pinnacle and silver is next. And so if gold is the hardest commodity money, it lasts the longest. And then you make the point, human beings who are able to take a longer view. I mean, your time horizon stretches out. You know, if you had seashells as money or carved wood sticks, your time horizon wouldn't last beyond the rotting of the wood sticks. Or your time horizon wouldn't last longer than when people trekked off to the seashore to get more seashells. So if gold is the hardest money of that time period and human beings were able to take a long view, they can create longer lasting structures, right? If you have a harder money, you can create a longer lived structure, and that structure would be an institution. And the hard money is working against time, right? Time is the impedance, and the money is flowing through time. So I started thinking about that as an engineer, and I thought materials progress from soft to hard, and we build with wood, and then we build with brick, and then we build with stone, and then we build with iron, and then we build with steel. And steel is right now, right, the winner of the materials. And using the hardest material, human beings are able to create the tallest structures, the largest and the tallest. They're working against gravity, right? So time is an elemental force. Gravity is an elemental force. So the significance of steel is I'm able to build a 100-story skyscraper. And the significance of strong money or gold money was maybe I could create a 50, 100-year-old dynasty of some sort. Maybe I could even build a cathedral based upon the gold. Money progresses from slower to faster. When we get to Bitcoin, you've got a harder money than gold. So if it's harder, that means in theory, you can build structures like institutions that will last longer than the gold institutions or the fiat institutions. I had the thought when Jack Dorsey just announced today that he put 500 Bitcoin into an institution or an endowment to finance Bitcoin development and with a focus on Africa and the like. So presumably Bitcoin development, Lightning development, et cetera. And I thought 500 Bitcoin will eventually be, if you don't spend it, it'll be worth $500 million. You know, we'll get to $1 million a coin, and then maybe Bitcoin will start to appreciate at 20% a year, 30%, and eventually it'll slow down. But you could borrow against $500 million, $50 million a year, which is enough to finance a development unit of hundreds of software developers forever. You know, a simple rule of thumb, 500 BTC might reasonably support 500 professionals working in an organization forever.
Wow.
Okay. Now, that's why, right? Because number goes up. It's a store of value. If I put the equivalent amount of money into government bonds, you know, the half-life is, you know, it's not going to support anything, right? Like 500 BC... You can calculate it today, right? That's, what is it? 2.5? No. 500 BTC is $25 million, right?
Yeah.
So $25 million invested in what? Something which is going up less than 20% a year is losing value, right? So I can't do it. And the S&P wouldn't work. Gold doesn't even work. They're both clocking at 15% a year. Sovereign debt doesn't work. So the NASDAQ sort of works. It's going up. Big tech sort of works, but you couldn't really say forever with big tech, you know, like, because it's tied in to, you know, it's got so many risks and complexities. So if I endow an institution with the hardest money, I could reasonably have a 100-year, multi-100-year time horizon. And I'd look you in the face and I say, yeah, it looks to me like 500 BTC will support 250 to 500 people. I mean, 250 at 200,000 a year, 500 at 100,000 a year. I mean, are you supporting people? If you're supporting people in Africa, developers in Africa, the cost per, right now, the cost per engineer is 25,000 to 50,000 a year, probably 25,000 a year. So you could support 500 people forever, or let's call it 1,000 years. I mean, we can go back and forth, but so hard money lets you work against time with an institution And then I think you've got this other dimension, which is it smarter and is it faster? Bitcoin is maybe 10 or 100 times harder than gold. And so we can look out hundreds and hundreds of years, but it's a million times faster than gold.
Yeah.
I pointed this out the other day. If you have a $1 billion block of gold, it's 30,000 pounds. Moving it across a continent is probably a $5 million 1,000-hour exercise, 1,000 hours to organize it. It's a few 747s, lots of armed guards, lots of diplomatic issues. So $5 million, 1,000 hours. And if I want to move a $1 billion block of Bitcoin, $5, 1 hour. A million times cheaper, 1,000 times faster right now. And so that means when money progresses from slower to faster, humans are able to create higher frequency structures. And they're working against space or against friction, right? So longer lived structures have to work against time. How am I going to endow the foundation for 1,000 years? And higher frequency structures are all about, I need to move $1 billion of gold every 2 hours, or $1 billion of money every 2 hours, not every 2 months. And the gold, of course, is so low frequency, it doesn't oscillate at all, right? I mean, like you have $1 billion. If you have 30,000 pounds of gold, how frequently does it move? I mean, didn't the French send that aircraft carrier to pick up their gold once in a century?
Yeah.
Like, isn't it like once a decade type thing? We're talking about velocity.
They did at least a lot of millions of dollars to send it when they repatriated their gold from the Fed. I can't remember how much it cost, but it was in the tens of millions of dollars, I think. And it took years to move Germany's gold. So it's very slow compared to Bitcoin.
Yeah, people that criticize Bitcoin for being slow, they're running these lab experiments in a garage on their little altcoin, moving no money around. And it's kind of like criticizing someone, you know, running a power reactor when you've got like a lighter in your hand, you know, it's like it's totally unrelated, right? It's silly. If you're going to compare the speed and the efficiency of Bitcoin, you have to compare it to the gold network, because you need to have final settlement on $1 billion of money, of tangible property. And you're not really getting $1 billion of settlement on a fiat network, you know, without so many other things. So I guess my point is, we have something which is going to last a lot longer. It's harder. And we have something which moves faster. So you create the potential of high frequency structures, which are inconceivable, like a bank that actually makes $1 billion loans and moves the money tangibly every day, every hour, every minute. There are certain structures people can't conceive of because they never thought about being able to tangibly move $1 billion of monetary energy in 37 minutes and then move it back. In the crypto world, they got this idea of flash loans. You know, maybe that's the closest thing. I don't know how enamored I am with a flash loan that lasts for like 400 milliseconds. I don't know. Like that, it seems to me to be interesting, but cute, maybe a little bit more gimmicky. I can definitely see the application of a loan that lasts 87 days. Or 31 days, or maybe moving a block of money for 187 days. If I can do it with two counterparties, two institutional counterparties without the banks in the middle and the governments in the middle, and we get to that in a second, this fiat issue, that opens up a new world. You could imagine in like 1600 in Renaissance Europe, they're building buildings with masonry and they're five stories high. And someone says, you know, one day we'll have steel and we're going to build 100 story skyscrapers, and they'll be shaped differently. You know, and the architects couldn't even conceive of that because they didn't have a material strong enough. I don't think people can conceive of the kind of banks or the kind of institutions that we'll have with high frequency money. And I think this last issue is money progresses from dumber to smarter. Humans are able to create more complex structures, and they're working against entropy, maybe complexity. Maybe entropy is the word. So we're either working against time, we got to be harder. We're working against space, we have to be faster. We're working against entropy, we got to be smarter. And the material is the semiconductor chip to make us smarter, combined with Bitcoin. And the material is the network to make us faster, combined with Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin is basically sitting on the network, on the chip, getting harder, faster, smarter. And the conclusion you come to is just like architecture, where I can break the laws of gravity. What did steel give us? It didn't just give us 50 or 100 story buildings. It also gave us cantilevers, and it also gave us bridges, right? And Carnegie made all his money, by the way. I read his biography. His big customers were municipalities buying iron and steel for bridges. Bridges are a pretty big deal, actually. And you can make the argument bridges may be even more important to civilization than skyscrapers. I mean, knock out the bridges in Manhattan and everybody starves to death.
Yeah.
You ever seen a bridge, you know, the bridge that connects San Francisco and Oakland, or the Bay Bridge that connects the Eastern Shore of Maryland to DC? With the bridge, it's a 1 hour commute. Without the bridge, it's a 12 hour commute, or it's 18 hour drive. In one case, I drive to work, and the other case, I don't.
Yeah. Right?
It ends the civilization. So I think that this element of money, I think you put your finger on something very fascinating, which is as the money gets harder, we can see further into the future with our institutions. But I think as it gets smarter and faster, we can construct institutions or relationships that are inconceivable before with slow, soft money. And I would say that takes us to fiat, right? I mean, fiat is softer money. It's faster than a block of gold, but it's still so much slower and stupider, right, than Bitcoin. Yeah.
It's manual. At the end of the day, at least gold is somehow automatic. It's a machine in a sense. It has its own truth within it. You can verify it, even though it's a little bit expensive. But with fiat, you know, it's ultimately manual. But day-to-day use, it is generally faster to move it around than moving around physical gold. But its real drawback, as you were saying, is in holding on to value for the future. That's where it's really not good. And in that sense, the way that I look at it is the harder the money, the more it incentivizes us to lower our time preference and therefore makes us think more and more about the future. Because the harder the money, the less uncertain the future. Because now you have something that, you know, I have this wealth, this monetary energy that I've stored, and I have more certainty in the fact that it's going to be there in a year or in 2 years or in 3 years. So then 1 year and 2 year and 3 years becomes more of a foreseeable thing for me, less of an uncertain thing for me. And so I start discounting less. When I start discounting it less, I start effectively lowering my time preference and providing for the future. And this is why I think, you know, the harder money got, you know, silver and gold were continuously getting harder, and then silver was eliminated and gold was hardest. That was the pinnacle of human achievement, arguably. This was when we made the most incredible technology. This is when we invented all these incredible things like the airplane and many, many, many things of the 19th century, which I discussed in the Bitcoin Standard. And I think in the 20th century, maybe we've reversed that process because our money is getting easier. And so the future is becoming less certain. And so we're becoming more high time preference because we discount the future more.
I agree with that. Yeah, I think you put your finger on something there, which is the future gets hazier and you see more anxiety. I mean, I know as a corporate CEO, in March, as I was staring at a block of $500 million US, and I was watching the money supply expand and the dollar devalue, my anxiety went through the roof, right? My anxiety went up so high that it kind of kicked me out of the fiat standard into the Bitcoin standard, right? Like boiling a frog or jumping out of the boiling whatever. I mean, it literally shocked me. It's all about engineering a mechanism or engineering security for yourself, right? I mean, steel allows me to stand on a cantilevered structure 100 feet over a canyon, or it allows me to stand on a bridge 1,000 feet over the Hudson River or the East River with security. I can even drive a car over it. And steel allows me to stand 800 feet in the air. right? And you imagine the insecurity of that, taking the structure away. The human beings are able to go to places with engineering, space stations, right? We're able to go places with engineering where otherwise you literally can't live. Like there's no life there without the engineering. You know, you got me thinking about the fiat standard and, you know, some of the criticisms I've heard lately about energy consumption of Bitcoin got me thinking about, well, what's the comparable system? And again, the critics are people that, again, they have a little toy railroad train in their garage and they think, well, my toy railroad train is more efficient than Bitcoin. But they don't really contrast the energy consumption of Bitcoin to the energy consumption of the alternative system that it is replacing. So if you look at the fiat system, money's got to do two things. It's got to be a medium of exchange and a store of value. And Bitcoin kind of is one structure and the fiat is another structure. So I look at the current system and I think, well, to make this work, when we replace the gold standard, I mean, the gold standard and it's when commodity money reached its pinnacle, I suppose after all the shuffling around, we eventually arrived at gold coins and silver coins. And gold, in my opinion, is store of value. And silver is the medium of exchange. Or, you know, one of them was the day-to-day currency. A gold coin with like, what, 8 grams, like a quarter of an ounce feels like it's about $500 coin. And so the gold coin is about 1 week's salary for a laborer. And you wouldn't have used a $500 coin or a $1,000 coin to pay for things routinely. But, you know, if I gave you a stack of 10 of them, that's your treasury. So the silver coin is the medium of exchange. And in that standard, you've got a very clean structure. Gold coin, silver coin, you mine the gold, you mine the silver, you mint the gold, you mint the silver, you store the gold, you store the silver. They all circulate around. And eventually, maybe they're gold notes, right? There are maybe some notes that are fractional or fully reserved banks moving that around. When we went to the fiat standard, we replaced that with the Treaty of Genoa. Got me thinking about this, Saifedean. Like, we replaced this with diplomats, corporations, accountants, lawyers, programmers, security guards, contractors, buildings, armies, software. Mints, we kept the mints, we kept the printers, we kept the gold mines, we kept the vaults, and then we tacked on ideas like ETFs, bond indexes, bond funds, financial managers, and everything else around them in order to create a medium of exchange and a store of value. I'm trying to figure out how much energy is consumed by, you know, what is it like 100,000 bank buildings or JP Morgan has 200,000 people. So I'm guessing there must be in the finance industry around the world, in the US it's like 8 million. So half of the finance industry is tied up in store of value, medium of exchange. So if we could figure it out, it'd probably be like 40 million people in the world. Maybe it's 20 to 40 million people. So what's the carbon footprint and the building footprint and the concrete footprint and the steel footprint and the electricity consumption of, and I was kind of kind, I'm not really allocating all the armies and the like, but you could probably say, if you really wanted to keep track of the real cost of the system.
But I include the proof of work system. So you got to put in the military.
Yeah. I mean, the first cost of the system is probably 20 million, 30 million bankers and financial advisors and the like. And then the secondary, that's the primary cost. The secondary cost is all the government infrastructure, the diplomats and the military officials and the aircraft carriers and the armies and the back and forth. I guess the third cost is actually the wars themselves that get waged back and forth. And then I think the fourth cost, the pernicious cost, I guess, is the inflation.
Yeah.
Right. If we're burning, you know, you said what, 7 or 8% was the monetary inflation on average. If there's $500 trillion of monetary assets and you're debasing 5% of it a year, even it's $25 trillion. So I don't know, $50 trillion a year? It must be $50 trillion. If we could somehow calculate that number, I mean, if you really want to do something useful, calculate the cost of the infrastructure, the banking infrastructure, then the governmental infrastructure, and then the cost of the first order cost of the currency debasement and the second order impact on the currency derivatives, the stocks, the bonds, and the real estate. And then after you've done that, you could throw in the business insolvency and the destruction of good enterprises and the political insolvency, destruction of good countries, right? The inefficiency of the system results in the destruction of entire countries. I guess the best example being like, right, the meltdown of the Weimar Republic due to the Treaty of Versailles, which was, I think, largely, you know, a result of poor treatment of debt and, you know, following World War One. I mean, they pretty much crashed that entire political system because of the way they layered the debt, you know, asymmetrically on the Germans and not on the French and the Americans. And, you know, that we know how that one ended, which wasn't good for anybody. I think we can see, you know, in the 20th century, we see an example of lots of countries destroyed by the fiat standard. I'm sensitive to all the companies destroyed by the fiat standard as well. The example of that is, as they keep cranking up the monetary expansion rate and as CEOs keep attempting to keep their stock hold value, the only way the stock can hold value is to expand the cash flows per share faster than the rate of money expansion. And that means that in an environment where the money's expanding at 7% a year, if your company's growing 3% a year, you can't store value in the stock. And the political pressure to hold value in the stock causes you to go take on massive debt. And then the massive debt is used to either issue dividends or to buy the stock back. And so what you're doing is you're taking on $1 billion of liabilities to actually pump the stock up, and then you're impoverishing the company. Eventually, you end up with the company having billions of dollars of debt, no equity. And then when you hit a crisis, like a technology crisis, like Amazon attacks Toys R Us, well, then you're insolvent. Or you have a pandemic crisis and they shut down, you know, your restaurant and you're insolvent. So the crises create insolvencies because the companies are undercapitalized because they took on debt under political pressure to keep their stock up. And you can see that playing out even right now, where the majority of, like we just saw, I'm not going to name the CFOs, but the majority of CFOs and CEOs will say, we're going to take our cash and buy our stock back. And conventional financial thinking is reward CEOs and CFOs for buying stocks back and issuing dividends and criticizes them for buying Bitcoin or tangible assets with their cash flows, right? Like I would be criticized as a speculator taking risk with my balance sheet, even though today I have $3.2 billion of tangible assets on my balance sheet. A year ago, I had $500 million. Right. And conventional wisdom is you should give away the 500 million and have zero. So conventional thinking is decapitalize the company and you're really ostracized or criticized if you convert cash from a weak asset to a strong asset. Right. Primarily by conventional thinking. I know I said a lot and I throw a lot out there, but I should pause and we should just talk about it because I think, you know, there's a lot of interesting implications and they start with this idea of the fiat system and the fiat standard.
Yeah, that is great. Thank you for that. Like the cost of the fiat standard is all of the things that you mentioned. And there's also the, just the business cycle, which is constantly causing misallocation of capital and businesses to make malinvestments, which get wiped out. all the time. And then there's the fact that, and this is primarily outside the US, it's a much bigger problem elsewhere, which is that you have the country's payments balances, all of their international account and their current account, all of it is settled with the central bank's cash balance, which is also used to back people's deposits in the banking system. And it is also used to buy government bonds. So essentially it's financing government bonds, and it backs the national currency. So you're constantly putting all of society's savings and all of society's ability to trade with the outside world, essentially as collateral for government to borrow against. And of course, the government has high time preference incentives to continue to abuse this all the time. And so it ends up creating all kinds of destruction of savings and destruction of capital. I think that's really, well, it's hard to estimate which is the biggest, but I think if you think about a century of misallocation of capital, and when you think that, you know, how much capital we've misallocated and how much capital was essentially leaked away from people, from prudent, productive people who had put it away to finance their future, and then suddenly it sort of go poof because their central bank had printed it. And all of that went to finance wasteful government spending and war and investment in things that were not chosen in the market. If you think about the opportunity cost of that over a century, I think the world would be a very different place. And I don't necessarily have to speculate about technological achievements that we haven't made, but I think with the things that we have, I think, you know, owning a house with electricity and, you know, 24-hour electricity and running water is probably something that would be attainable for everybody in the world if money was hard. You know, if you think about it, anybody, particularly people in the poorest countries in the world, if they had had gold for the last century, it would be almost trivial for people to be able to secure a modern house with electricity and running hot water as a basic infrastructure. I think the upside of where we would be is almost unimaginable for people in our position. But I think the bare minimum would be that basic technology would be far cheaper all over the world and far more easily available because people could afford them. It's not that expensive to build an engine that gives you 24-hour electricity. It's a really simple engineering problem that's been solved in many places in the world for many, many decades. And it just keeps getting cheaper every year. And I think, you know, the reason that many people in the world don't have it is because they have bad money that just continues to lose value. And it ruins their time preference, as we were saying earlier. It prevents them from thinking of the future.
One thing that's interesting to me is in the perfect gold standard, the store of value is a gold coin and the medium exchange is a silver coin. As I read the fiat standard, I see, you know, we kind of had to abandon the gold standard because we needed faster money and we needed larger quantities of it. You know, we replaced the gold standard with this network of tens of thousands of banks and hundreds of central banks and armies of accountants and lawyers and bureaucrats. The currency was the medium of exchange, the store of value when the fiat system worked. First, they tried the store of value as gold, right? It seems like they layered on fiat currency over gold to try to do that. And then over time, as the gold got seized and it was synthetic gold or hypothecated gold. And then in 71, that kind of, the semblance of that started breaking down. And then the store of value in the fiat system was sovereign debt. If we look at the world today, there's all the currency and the theoretical store of value, right? If you ask a corporate treasurer, what are you going to do with your treasury? I need to store my value. Well, I don't hold it in cash outright. I would hold it in government debt, right? Treasuries were the gold, but the gold standard, right, is treasuries. And by the way, that kind of worked. Like, for example, the currency system used to have international currency trading used to kind of work. There was price discovery in the market. For example, you remember when, you know, Greek debt was trading, what was it, like 8% or 9 or 10%? And I remember Spanish debt or Italian debt used to trade 5, 6%. I would say if you go back to before the EU was formed and you had all these countries with all their different currencies, the currencies were in a competitive market And if a country wanted to keep its currency from collapsing, you had to raise the interest rate. So you remember when people used to have 12% interest rates and 8%? By the way, under the Volcker regime, we go back to the 80s, you had Ronald Reagan. He was fairly conservative. Volcker was conservative. There you had the fiat standard, but they, you know, they took the interest rates to 18% in the US. Thinking was countries had to compete to make the currency viable. You know, you had to have interest rates that were market set. And in that world, you had 8% 30-year bonds and you had 5% bonds. In 2010, short-term interest rates were 5%. So you remember you were saying, well, you know, like the money supply was expanding at like 7 or 8%, maybe 7% or something. In that world, if I'm a corporate treasurer, I can get 5 or 6% on bonds, call it credit-worthy bonds, right? AAA credit. The store of value in the fiat system, when it works, and we'll go back to good old days. Ronald Reagan, maybe it was the good old days. When it works, you buy credit grade bonds, AAA rated, you buy sovereign debt, it yields 4, 5, 6%. The money supply expands either 3% or 7%. Say it's expanding at 7 or 8%. You're getting a 2% loss or 1% loss. I give you $100 million, the half-life of the money is 35 years. So in that world, you can have a, by the way, 35 years or 30 years is kind of a magic number. It's your career, say, Fidine. So if I'm a CEO or I'm a corporate treasurer and I'm running on the fiat standard in that time period, I can take my capital, I can put it into like credit-worthy bonds, not take a lot of execution risk, not try to guess, you know, what happens with Zoom versus Tesla, and I'm not quote unquote speculating, right?
Yeah.
The fiat standard, when it works, gives you sovereign debt and credit instruments that allow me as a responsible corporate treasurer to protect the assets of the company for the next 20 to 30 years, long enough for the company to execute its business strategy. That used to work, but then something started breaking down over the last 30 years. And today it's busted. There's no price discovery. Sovereign debt is not a store of value. Last week, the junk bond index dipped below 5%. It was 4.9%. Okay, the theoretical risk on junk bonds, the risk of default to anybody is 4%. But to a rational person, it feels like it's 8%. It's 4 to 8% is the risk on the bond, which means that if you're getting 4% yield, you're at best zero. And at worst, it's a negative real yield of 4% or something after credit adjustment. So that tells you that corporate bonds, sovereign debt, and junk bonds are no longer stores of value, and currencies yield no interest. The U.S. 30-year swap was 72 basis points a year ago. Today, it's 180 or 175 basis points, and that's the best you're going to get. The EU 30-year swap is 20 basis points. It's nothing. There's no yield. So what can you say? You can say the fiat standard has broken down starting the year 2020 because at this point, there is no tangible store of value, or all the traditional treasury instruments are no longer stores of value. Now, when did it start? And I'm going over this in my head, and I just, forgive me, I read your book, you got me thinking, I'm literally thinking about this morning, but I'm thinking, I think it started to break down with the Japanese in the 1980s. I think the Japanese had a crisis. The crisis was the digital revolution. Computer chip came out, Intel, Microsoft. The Japanese dominate analog electronics. The world shifts to digital electronics. Their exports start slipping. And as the world moves to the computer age, the Japanese economy weakens. Their reaction is the central bank starts to intervene. They're a closed system, an authoritarian, a single government in a closed system under economic crisis. And so they start buying everything. Price discovery disappears. Asset inflation goes through the roof. Real estate in Tokyo goes through the roof. Zombie companies start to manifest themselves. The economy freezes. And that's the first place you see the breakdown of the fiat standard. The interest rate goes to laughable numbers. Non-competitive, And it's like this self-referential closed system. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And America looks at it and we're, you know, in America, we have 18% interest rates, you know? And so the Japanese response was central bank intervention. And they were the first major country. And maybe not the first, because I'm not a student of China and every other country. I just noticed in Japan. Then what happens next? America has the Reagan Revolution. And so Reagan and Volcker really define the game plan until 88. And we have the fiat system lurching toward normal. You had savings accounts that yield 6, 7, 8% interest. You know, the way you know that there's a semblance of normalcy is checking accounts yield 0 and savings account yield 8% interest, and the banking system offers those things. You know, a savings account allows me to save money. If the money supply is debasing at 7% a year and the savings account is yielding 7% interest, there's some hope. You know, when I was a kid, there was hope. And then Clinton came in, and Clinton inherited a great economy, and Microsoft's killing it, and there's the internet revolution, and Google and Apple, and this is the rise of America. And all of a sudden, we thought the Japanese were going to own everything in America. They were buying the Rockefeller Center, Sony was crushing everybody, et cetera. So we lurched in 1980, an inflection point. America got its mojo back, and we thought technology and the internet, you know, that makes us leaders. We didn't think we were world economic leaders when Reagan was elected. I mean, people really thought the Japanese, they were setting up Toyota plants. We're going to, there's a movie Gung Ho. We thought we're going to be working for the Japanese. The world took a left turn. The Japanese economy missed the digital revolution. And I think this is deep-seated in the Japanese language. It's a pictographic language. They didn't have the programming skills. They missed the digital revolution. America started to rise. The rise of the Westernet, Western Europe, the U.S. started to prosper from digital productivity. And Clinton inherited this very healthy economy from Reagan. And Clinton was kind of a moderate. And we went on to 2000. And then what happens in 2000? The EU. Okay. And before the EU, you had all these different currencies. And when you crossed Europe, every currency had to have its own interest rate and its own bank. And they're competitive with each other. And if a currency prints too much, their currency crashes and no one's going to save them. And so there are interest rates. You go look at the interest rate. They're real interest rates. So it's like a 7%, a 6%, an 8%. Right? There are consequences to irrationality under the fiat standard when there's 100 central banks and they're all competing, right? And you talked about in your book, you're like, there's all these central banks. The US as the currency swap was, it wasn't 87 or 90% of all currency. It was like 30. You can see this manifested itself in 1980 because when you had different currency systems, the Chinese, the Japanese, the Indian, South America, the German bank, the UK, the French, the US, they're all different currency systems. You know, and the US had to raise their interest rates, and there are consequences to our inflation. We had to take interest rates to 18 or 19% to actually fix that problem. We couldn't print money with impunity. It's like pissing in your own bathtub, right? It's a small bathtub. And there are consequences to foiling your own bathtub. But when it's a big ocean, there are no consequences. And you feel like you can, you know, if you print $1 trillion in a $10 trillion economy, that's a problem. And if you print $1 trillion in a $50 trillion global economy, that's 2%, right? That just goes away, right? So in 1980, you couldn't do it. And we started lurching toward globalism. And then the EU was this big change. And what happened? Well, the EU came in with a light hand, but it was a massive increase in governmental authority and fiat authority, because now you had an EU central bank. In my opinion, you know, the biggest beneficiary of the EU, when the EU formed, the biggest beneficiary was the US, because you saw every local country. Yeah.
It limited the ability of Deutschmark from competing with the US dollar. I think that was really the, it gave the dollar a lease of life because it tied the Deutschmark with weaker European currencies.
Here's what I saw. When I traveled through Europe in the 90s, there were 10 languages. The menus were in 10 different languages, 10 different currencies. I had to change money in every border. I started with $1,000. I ended with the quote of $780 or $900. The money changing was expensive, and I couldn't read the street signs. When you travel through Europe after the formation of the EU, all the menus converted to English. EU adopted English as the second language. You've converted to the euro. And if you're living in Portugal or you're living in France or you're living in Spain, you're thinking, well, I had to give up Portuguese and Spanish and Italian for English. And I had to give up the peseta and the lira for the euro, but I might as well just go ahead and convert it to the dollar. The Italians aren't going to adopt French. And so it's almost like all the Europeans agreed to adopt English, and then they started pegging to the dollar. And the U.S. was the big beneficiary of the formation of the EU, because now everybody had to accept English and the dollar. And that played into TCP/IP and the internet and Google and Facebook and Apple and Amazon. And the entire U.S. economy benefited. And it was U.S. San Francisco progressive views, San Francisco technology, U.S. law. The American legal and economic and cultural system encroached on Europe in a big way. We saw the formation of a Westernet, I'll call it, Western Europe and the United States, a billion-person trading block, trading in dollars, convertible dollars, trading in English language, subject to basically U.S. trade law. So what happened next? Well, the EU was weak. And there was a crisis, and it used to be that if I wanted to buy Italian bonds, I could get 8% yield or 7% yield. And the German bond yield was 2%. And the Germans had the best credit rating, and the French were next. But the Portuguese had a weaker one, and the Italians had an awful credit rating, and their bonds yielded great. And the Greeks, at some point, you could probably go back and pull the bond yields. It probably tells the story of the death of the fiat standard, right? Or the encroachment of the fiat standard. If you look at bond yields in European countries from 2000 on, there's a point at which they all pretty much pegged to the EU bond yield, right? And that was as the EU central bank started taking responsibility for the default of the Greeks. Probably the Greek crisis was probably a seminal event. When the EU bailed out Greece, that was an expansion of the EU central bank. I almost think about two crises. We had the great financial crisis when the United States bailed out every bank and we forced them all to take hundreds of billions of dollars. And we bailed out every European bank with US dollars. And it seems like once we did that, we owned them all. Like the US dollar as the world reserve currency, it went from being 30% to 40% to 60% to 80% to 90% after that crisis. And it seems like after the debt crisis of Greek and after the Italian debt crisis, when the EU central bank bailed out those countries, the EU kind of owned them as well. The summary is, by the time this is all said and done, interest rates in the European Union have crashed to zero. Short-term interest rates are negative. Long-term interest rates, they were like 8 basis points for 30-year money on a swap a few weeks ago. And so what you really got is the massive expansion of the EU central bank and the Fed from the year 2000 to the year 2020. And as they expanded, all corporate debt, all sovereign debt stopped being an effective store of value. The currencies became dominant. And for whatever reason, the U.S. currency just got progressively stronger and stronger from 1980 to the year 2020. And now, the entire transformation has taken its hold.
So I guess what you're saying is basically Bitcoin eats the store of value market. So what assets do you see that essentially disrupting? What do we get rid of? Do you think government bonds make sense anymore? Or do you see them phased out?
I bet you can track this. The early fiat standard had gold as a store of value, the early fiat stage. And then the mid stage of the fiat standard, I think, had sovereign debt as a store of value. And then I think the late stage, the twilight years of the fiat standard, I think it has stock indexes. The rise of the Vanguard 500 and John Bogle and the S&P, the Dow, the S&P, the NASDAQ, these stock indexes, they emerged as a store of value, I don't know, maybe 2010. At what point did the Swiss central bank start holding stocks?
2011, I think.
Okay, bingo. When I was getting started in business, nobody would have reasonably considered stock index as a as a store of value. They thought it was an investment. But Vanguard was very successful, and the S&P 500 is very successful. And I think people at some point realized bonds are only covering half of inflation. Cash isn't covering anything. And the stock indexes start to track your monetary expansion, say, Fadeen. I think they're, pretty close, right? Like S&P is like 7-8% a year for a decade.
Yep.
I think that the free market migrated. I mean, the death of the savings account forced everybody probably into first bond indexes and then stock indexes. And today, 22-year-old Uber driver knows that the savings account is worthless. You know, if I have cash at like some of these bulge bracket banks, you know, in their money market funds, they're actually charging like, they're offering 15 basis points yield and charging 25 basis points management fee. The fee is higher than the yield on the account. The marketplace has migrated and it's being forced. And stage one was gold, stage two was sovereign debt, and then the rise of corporate AAA rated debt. You could almost say that in order to replace the gold standard, we had to have an army of credit rating agencies, Moody's and S&P. And you could say the rise of the junk bond market might be explained by this. People desperately chasing after store of value without equity risk. Finally, they threw in the towel and they started absorbing some equity risk. And then in 2020, we kind of kicked the thing into high gear, right? March of 2020 is the point where everything just breaks. Like, because 5-7% money expansion against an 8% S&P index and against a 5% bond yield or 4% credit worthy yield and 8% to 10% junk bond yield, you can sort of almost make that work. But it stops working when the money supply expands by 25% and the S&P yield is 15% and the junk bond yield is 4%
and arguably
the sovereign yield is 0% or 1%.
And arguably it only worked in the 80s and the 90s because essentially it was financed by borrowing from the future through manipulated interest rates. And so effectively, you know, it's not like it was working and now it broke. It was a short-term fix that was inevitably going to break down eventually.
I think right now the only two store, and by the way, the people are smarter in some ways than the politicians and the mainstream media, because even the 23-year-old Uber driver knows that they're probably better off to buy Tesla stock or buy a market basket of technology stocks, or even take a flyer on GameStop or buy Bitcoin than they are to put their money in a savings account and wait. I think that what's happened is people have migrated. The smart money has determined that there's only two stores of value left. Really smart money that's brave says Bitcoin. If you're really progressive and if you got some courage, then you realize that the best store of value is Bitcoin. It's digital gold. The other layer of smart money that is either very comfortable, they're already wealthy, they've got plenty of money and they're comfortable, or they're conventional. The comfortable, conventional smart money has decided that big tech or growth is the store of value. And that's the best surrogate for that is NASDAQ. If I go right now, case for Bitcoin, and I look, what does that show me? ROI 1 year, it's saying Bitcoin is 356% up. NASDAQ is up 43%, gold is up 14.7%, S&P is up 16%, and treasuries are 2%. And your money expansion was 25%, or what, you know, whatever you want to plug in. And if you plug in 15% going forward, you can see you'll tread water with gold and S&P, maybe. By the way, I wouldn't. I think that you're more likely to tread water with the S&P. I think with gold, gold is in a parabolic it's a ballistic trajectory. It got a boost in the crisis. Now it's losing momentum. It's broken down in the last 6 months and it's about to crash. And you're going to see people short gold, reallocate from gold. The price is going to crash. And it's probably the scariest possible investment right now, because gold only exists as long as people are looking for a non-sovereign store of value. And you only need one, right? And there's only one that can be. And you pretty much have to be brain dead to be allocating to gold versus Bitcoin in the year 2021. You're just going to have to like go through mental gymnastics. So I can buy the argument that I buy a market basket of all the stocks because you know you're just buying the economy. But I can't really buy the argument of gold anymore. And of course, treasuries are disasters because you're long money. Not only are you taking on cash that's losing 15% of its purchasing power a year, you're locking yourself in for 20 to 30 year duration. By the time you get the cash back, you're going to have lost 95% of your money. So that's just foolish. But you've got growth, right? Everybody wants growth. They'll take growth, discounting risk to zero. They'll even take the prospect of growth, right? Like if you just tell me a story, and if I can't have growth, then they'll buy GameStop because at least there's the potential of, if I can't have growth, I'll take speculation of growth. And if I can't have speculation of growth, I'll just take speculation of a short squeeze. All of those are more compelling than anything left in the fiat system.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Bitcoin becomes more and more compelling over time. Sure, there'll definitely be stocks, and investing in stocks has its place. But I think for the store of value market, that's going to be distinct from money that you want to risk on high growth, high risk stocks. So the interesting thing will be to see how this develops. Now, you've been saying that you don't think Bitcoin threatens the dollar. So would you say that Bitcoin threatens treasuries, but doesn't threaten the dollar, and therefore... You know, we can continue to see maybe just more inflation in the dollar, but governments continue to reevaluate against Bitcoin and continue to collect taxes from Bitcoin. So Bitcoin replaces their treasuries, puts them on a tight leash, and makes their inflation a little bit more transparent, but their dollar continues to survive. Is that how you see it?
I don't think it's very constructive for the community to focus upon Bitcoin replacing the dollar. It's like, it's a crypto anarchist idea. I could be more supportive of Bitcoin replacing the Zimbabwe dollar or the Venezuelan bolivar. Like in a government where all the institutions of government are broken down, an utterly corrupt, dysfunctional government where they can't function anymore. And that's a hyperinflationary environment. I'm probably more supportive of that, right? Because there, people are going to starve to death. So there's billions of people in collapsing economies where the currency is collapsing. There, some kind of stable currency, it might be even a stable coin, like the US dollar sitting on a crypto rail backed by Bitcoin, which might be what Tether is or what something is. I think that that's probably got a value, right? I mean, that's probably got a place. But in the United States and in Europe, as the fiat currency expands, it maintains its place as a medium of exchange and a lawful currency and as currency, I mean, as legal currency. And it will, and we should hope it will, because I don't think anybody wants, you know, France or Germany or the US to look like Zimbabwe, right? I mean, those are literally countries where the rule of law and the right to property break down. When the rule of law and your right to freedom of speech or the right to life, liberty, and property break down, you've got a situation of true anarchy. And then I suppose if you're a crypto anarchist and you support reinstalling free speech and right to property via crypto network, that's ethical, right? So I get that, right? That makes sense. But in a country that has a rule of law and a right to property, the logical thing that happens is when people lose faith in the currency, they migrate to gold. When gold isn't fast enough, but gold is an antiquated elitist asset, right? I mean, the criticism of gold that people should focus on is that it's elitist. How do 500 million people buy $1,700 worth of gold? Calculate what is the markup on $1,700 worth of gold coins purchased $87 at a time, right? Yeah. I mean, isn't that like 40% markup? Like, aren't you looking at, I mean, you want elitist is I'm going to basically pay double, right? I mean, even coins are expensive. If you want to get gold at a reasonable price, you have to buy a bar of London Good Delivery gold, which is 400 ounces at a time. That's $800,000 blocks of gold. And you probably have to buy like five of them from JP Morgan to get treated anywhere close to reasonably, right? So gold is an elitist store of value. It is not accessible to the billion people in the Western world, in Western Europe and the US. It's certainly not accessible to the 7.8 billion people on the planet. And so if you're going to deliver a store of value to everybody with a mobile phone on Earth, Bitcoin is your best bet. Bitcoin is going to be running transaction fees of, less than 1%. 1-2% would be high, you know, like whatever it is, it's going to be nothing compared to the cost to acquire and store and maneuver gold. Gold is elitist and gold is antiquated because I can't move $37 worth of gold, you know, from point A to point B to pay for an Uber ride. I can't fund with gold. Gold is not bankable. Gold is slow money. With Bitcoin, we're on the verge of a world where, you know, you'll have $1 trillion of Bitcoin. You can plug 1 billion consumer accounts into it and you can offer people the ability to borrow against the Bitcoin at 4% interest. By the way, JP Morgan offers you securitized loans up to loan to value 50% against conventional assets at LIBOR plus 50 basis points if you're an institutional customer. You could get LIBOR plus 200 basis points if you're a consumer. So you're talking about 2% interest or 3% interest. So in a world where a major bank were to plug into Bitcoin, there's no reason why we couldn't get to a point where 1 billion people could borrow money against Bitcoin at 2% interest and then never sell the Bitcoin forever. I think in the next 36 months, we'll see 5%, 4-5% consumer loans against Bitcoin. When's the last time you got a loan against gold? No, you know, and then we're on to this next thing, which is, okay, well, we'll write off gold. Well, what's next? Well, bond indexes? No. So we migrate to stock indexes. I think the free market in the Western world is inventing asset classes to serve as stores of value. And they've been doing them legally and ethically. And the government allows you to create asset classes. I mean, when $1 trillion moved into the Vanguard 500, the S&P 500, the government didn't block that. So I think that the right way to think of it is Bitcoin as a store of value asset class, as digital gold growing to be $10 trillion and then 20 and then 40. The big model I have is a monetary planet. And let's say the monetary planet is $500 trillion. It's a gaseous planet. The outside of it is $100 trillion worth of M2 or M3 money, currency, derivatives, and the like, euros, dollars. And so that's currency that's moving through all the governments on Earth. And that's going to continue as long as there are governments on Earth. Then inside that is $400 trillion worth of other assets. And it's broken up between real estate and collectibles and stocks and credit instruments and bonds and derivatives. 350 trillion of the 400 trillion, or I don't know. So maybe it's not that. Maybe 200 trillion of the 400 trillion is what I'll call currency derivatives. Their value is based substantially or in part on the discounted value of the future cash flows of the asset. So stocks valued on future cash flows, real estate value, commercial real estate valued on future cash flows, and bonds valued on future cash flows, those are currency derivatives. Now, inside that is a higher quality set of assets. I'm going to call them trophy assets, collectible assets. A beach house in the Hamptons, Palm Beach, a Picasso, even a trophy equity. To the extent that I brag about owning Disney because I own Disney because I love Mickey Mouse, because Mickey Mouse was part of my formative experiences. A trophy piece of debt. It's a piece of debt for the children's hospital in my neighborhood because they saved my kid's life. Like something that you would hold and you would value because it's part of your self-identity. A football team, soccer franchise. Things that people love and they would hold them irregardless of the discounted, of the forecast of the discounted cash flows in the future. Your personal home, right? Your personal home has value to you. Your personal car, your personal yacht, your personal plane. These things have value to you because you love them and they will be pried from your cold, dead fingers. And it doesn't matter what the interest rate is. It's your house. It's your lake house. So that stuff is more, is harder asset. And then in the middle of that is a $10 trillion hardcore of gold, which we'll call non-sovereign store of value, fungible money. And inside that, the center of the earth is this, isn't this this burning red hot thing at the center of the earth? That's crypto. There's a $1 trillion crypto fire in the middle of the $500 trillion planet. And that $1 trillion crypto fire was started from a spark by Satoshi. And it's burning, and it went from a billion to 10 billion to 100 billion to a trillion, the Bitcoin fire. And that is the hardest, fastest, smartest, strongest monetary asset in the history of the human race. And it is expanding and it is boiling these things, and it is boiling gold. And then the first thing it's going to do is it's going to replace gold. And gold will collapse into the crypto fire. And then it will suck in sovereign credit instruments, negative yielding sovereign debt, to the extent that that's held as a store of value. It will subsume some debt indexes and some equity indexes. And it'll probably expand from 10 trillion to 20 to 40 to 80 to 100. And it could get all the way to say 200 trillion. And when it's 200 trillion, it'll be the stabilizing framework. And the gaseous monetary planet will go from 500 trillion up by 10% to 550. Maybe it's plus 15% a year, right? If it's plus 15% a year, your $500 trillion monetary planet will expand to become an $800-900 trillion. What's after a trillion? It's a quadrillion. We're headed toward a quadrillion, a quad planet, and Bitcoin will expand it. It's at 250-300% a year for the last decade. And that's about as fast as it can go, because anything faster than that, you know, rips the wings off the airplane. Human beings, people ask, how fast can human beings accept change? I think if you look at the history of business, companies growing faster than 200% a year are rare. I mean, that's pretty much as fast as it can go. So it'll go 200%. And it'll track that way. And I think at some point when it crosses gold, it'll slow down to 150% and 120%. You could probably work it out over the next 20 years as it goes from a trillion up to 200 trillion. Might take 30 years, might take 20 years, might take 10 years, somewhere between 10 and 30 years, right? If you look at the rate and where we're headed is a world where there's 8 billion people on the planet with a mobile phone, and those 8 billion people are storing value in digital gold, and probably that mobile device is going to have a hardware wallet embedded in it that's going to be the token, and you'll have multi-signature, multi-hardware wallets securing digital gold, which has become, I don't know, what is it going to be, a third or half? You have to ask the question theoretically, Saifedean, what portion of the monetary planet should rationally be store of value? And I think it's self-equilibrating because as more monetary energy, it's like magnetism, you're demagnetizing something, you're demonetizing something. As more monetary energy falls off of gold and off of silver and then off of indexes into Bitcoin, price discovery will return to these other assets. So price discovery is going to return to gold. It's going to approach its ornamental and antique value. And price discovery will return to silver, and price discovery will return to stocks and bonds. What you can assume is that in a free market, price discovery will return, the bond prices will fall, the yields will increase, real estate prices will fall, the yields will increase for commercial real estate. You will see stock prices fall, dividend yields and yields will increase. Everything will rationalize in a free market. Market dynamics, conventional, you know, market theory dictates that no asset can be any more attractive than any other asset in a free market because capital will flow and migrate so as to equalize the expected return on all assets. Now, what you're going to see is certain markets become not free, right? I mean, the way you break that is you pass laws. And there'll be, you know, in the extreme cases, there'll be what you're seeing going on in India right now. What you saw in China makes it impossible to convert renminbi into Bitcoin. And India is threatened by it. Nigeria is threatened by it. You're going to see back and forth, and you'll see some countries will embrace it and other countries will run from it. But, you know, the Chinese made Google illegal. Twitter's illegal. Facebook's illegal, right? That's going to happen. And it didn't stop them from being successful other places. I think you'll probably see the Western world will embrace digital gold. I think you'll see banana republics, corrupt regimes attempt to resist it. On the other hand, you know, I've traveled all through China and everybody's got a VPN and they're looking at Twitter and Facebook accounts with VPNs. It's really difficult. And there's, can they actually stop it? Not really, right? I mean, they can't stop it. They actually have a hard time stopping money traveling on crypto rails over VPNs and the Tor network. On the other hand, will they suffer from it? Yeah, there's a big cost to not have Google. I mean, there's a big cost to not have YouTube, right? There's a big cost to not have electricity, right? There's cost to reject technology. If your money moves a million times faster, then that means the cost of capital for the world that embraces the technology drops. And that means that innovation accelerates. And you can cling to your gold coins and your giant stone coins of the Yap people and the whatever. But it, at some point, there's a cost of not having Google Maps, man. Try, you know, cars that don't drive themselves, you know?
Yeah.
There's a cost, and eventually reflects itself in the Cuba standard of living or the North Korean standard of living. And even the Chinese can't necessarily stop this thing. So bottom line is, I think the fiat system is going to continue as a currency, and it should, right? The currency rails work fine. What people still haven't got through their head is I could have 150% of my assets in Bitcoin. All right. You can have $1 million. You can buy $1 million in Bitcoin. You can mortgage your house, buy another 500,000 in Bitcoin. You can take out a personal loan against your future earnings if you're a doctor, buy another 500 Bitcoin. If it was me, I'd mortgage my house, I'd sell my gold, and I would raise debt, and I would buy Bitcoin. You can have 100% of your assets in Bitcoin. Get a bank that will give you a loan against Bitcoin. If Bitcoin is going up at 25% a year, and if your expenses are going up at 5% a year, you can borrow money to pay for your coffee and to pay your rent and to drive your car and to live your life forever, never pay it back, keep the Bitcoin, and your debt to equity ratio will fall. And so at some point, you could literally fund everything in Bitcoin. And so you don't need to replace the dollar is my point. You don't really want to spend Bitcoin. What you want to do is you want to plug your Bitcoin account into a Visa card, and you want to pay for things with Visa, and you want to run up a debt, and you never want to pay it off, and you want to die owing money. Because it's not that complicated. You have $1 million and it doubles every year. You eventually have $100 million. You can spend $100,000 a year going up at 20% a year, or you can spend $100,000 going up at 50% a year, and you will die with $90 million of equity, $10 million in debt, never having paid tax. Why? Yeah. And you don't need to replace the euro. You don't need to replace the dollar. You don't need to get rid of your Visa card. Right? Those things don't matter.
Yeah, I think another argument in favor of this is the fact that maybe Bitcoin is actually reducing the demand for the creation of dollars and euros, because if people don't buy as many treasuries as they do, then fewer dollars are created. If people don't get into as much debt, then fewer dollars are created. And so people are holding Bitcoin instead of holding debt instruments on their balance sheet, then less debt takes place. And as the key concept in the fiat standard is that fiat is debt. So basically Bitcoin reduces the demand and the supply for fiat. But I guess it's you know, unfortunately, it's not a choice we get to make. It's an outcome of markets. So the question is, can the dollar hold on, and can the people printing the dollar manage to maintain the Bitcoin storm? I guess that's what we'll see. But there are reasons why we can see Bitcoin continue to grow without the dollar having to collapse. I've got another question for you, and switching gears a little bit. You've waltzed into the Bitcoin world at a very, very good time. You know, you came in at, what was it, 7,000 or 8,000 or 9,000, and you know, within a couple of weeks, we are now almost at 50. It's at 47, I think, right now. Obviously, part of that is probably you and the impact that you have had and all the evangelism that you've done. But also, you know, we've had periods in Bitcoin before where prices have declined for quite a while. So, you know, if this was high school, you know, you would be signing up for high school the week of the prom and the graduation. You didn't sit with us through the dark days of, you know, buying the $1,000 top and watching it go down to $150 over 2 years. So I'm wondering, you know, you went in at a time when this was a possibility. We could have had another 2 years. You know, you may have chanced upon the Bitcoin in 2018, and Bitcoin hasn't changed much between 2018 and 2020. But if you bought in March 2018, you know, you would have witnessed the decline for quite a while. So I'm wondering, was your entry, you know, were you just thinking, all right, this is better technology, I'm just going to be buying as much as I can? Or was there some kind of price analysis going on, in the sense of, we've consolidated for a while, so most likely we're going to be getting another jump. Would you have bought as aggressively in 2018? And do you follow any particular models for thinking of the price?
So say, first of all, it's better to be lucky than good.
Absolutely.
And I would say to you, I'm very lucky.
Like, you're also very good.
When I look back at my life, I can count all sorts of fortunate occurrences. So I'm lucky. Second, I think the best time in human history to buy Bitcoin was starting in March of 2020, right? If you want to look at this entire thing, starting in March of 2020, the world changed forever. That was the risk reward point, where the risk had diminished by 99% and the return and the use case had amped by a factor of 100. Like, it was an inflection point in March of 2020. Look, I wouldn't have bought it at all in February of 2020. I didn't know it existed. I didn't really care or think about it. The world was totally different in February versus in April. So I think March is the beginning of the new era. I think that people in the Bitcoin industry, I think that they're, to a certain degree, they're biased by their history, and it's a liability for them. I think it's baggage that they should lose. I think most people in the Bitcoin industry and most people in business, most people in life, they want to draw on their experience, because there's a bias that I want to make decisions based on my experience, and I want to feel that everything that I experienced was worthwhile. And if I felt pain, I would like for it to have meant something. Right. So what if I looked at you and I said, safe, like nothing that you experienced between 2010 and 2020 was relevant, and you could basically flush it all down a toilet and take a clean sheet of paper and start again. That doesn't feel good, right? Like psychologically, it's hard to let go of that. But let me give you an example of inflection point. For 10 years before March, we had tried to use video conferencing, and I used WebEx. And my experiences were uniformly awful for the entire 10 years. I could probably write a book on all of the bad meetings and all of the awful dysfunctional business results that came from that. And I fired people that wanted to use video conferencing and wanted to work remotely the previous year. Okay. And I had lots of experience. And then in March, we decided to use Zoom, and Zoom was 100 times better. And I had only good experiences. And the truth of the matter is, the entire decade of experience I had with video conferencing was of no value whatsoever. It actually just saddled me with a prejudicial bias, because I had scars and I had pain, and it's all irrelevant. Okay, so after March, everybody on Earth needed Bitcoin. 1,000 companies. You heard Russ last week. He said, I had 20 clients at the beginning of the year. I had 280 institutional clients at the end of the year. I have 90 in the pipeline now. Russ will have 1,000 clients. He'll go from 20 to 1,000. All of his experience before March, all of your forecasts before March, irrelevant. It's what I said to Keith McCullough. All your models, destroyed. Why are they destroyed? Because they're based upon the statistical interaction. A tidal wave hits the beach. Okay, I drop a bomb on your head. Your entire history, living in the town or playing on the beach, irrelevant. Irrelevant. You want it to matter. It doesn't matter, right? When $100 trillion of capital comes through a nozzle, it doesn't matter. You know, like if you took every trade of Bitcoin from the point that Satoshi did the whatever and the pizza transfer took place all the way through, you know, the blow off top, all of it is irrelevant. Let me explain it a different way. If Elon Musk woke up tomorrow and decided, screw it, I'm buying $10 billion of Bitcoin instead of $1.5 billion of Bitcoin, that one decision renders irrelevant all of the studying of Bitcoin's trajectory between today and March, last March. One person, one thing makes a difference. And likewise, March rendered irrelevant the statistical models in the history before. What's going on right now is, on February 8th, on Monday, the day that you woke up, if you read the news, the world changed again. You have to keep redoing your models. The human race, right? I mean, read paleo theory. We ran around getting chased by wolves and apes for 3 or 4 million years and starving to death. Life was difficult. And 10,000 years ago, we invented agriculture. Life changed again. 100 years ago, life changed again. The life of a human being today, the challenges, the dynamic. How many children get up and worry about getting eaten by a wild animal today, right? It's like, it's irrelevant, right? That the history of the human race is irrelevant to a decision. Like, you're going to get in a car and drive the car. You can kill yourself in 3 seconds. What matters is you're in the frickin' car. When you engineer a new system, it completely renders irrelevant your history. If I take a gun and I point it at your head and there's a bullet in it, nothing in the world that you've lived through matters other than, can you get me to not pull the trigger? Everything else is irrelevant. And so engineering machines and when your circumstances change, when you're skiing down a ski slope and there's an avalanche, all your skill as a skier rendered irrelevant. All your skill as a human being. It's back to this issue of the guy that was the chairman of HNA. He was the richest man in China, worth $30 billion. 2 years ago, he went hiking in the south of France, stood on a rock wall, had a selfie taken, tripped, and fell to his death. All of his money, all of his models, all of his lawyers, 87 million freaking people in China, irrelevant. In 1 second, he broke the law of gravity and he died. The point here is Bitcoin has moved into a different zone, a phase shift. It was in one phase from 2010 to 2015 and went through another phase, 2015 to 2018. When Bitcoin pulled ahead after the fork wars, it moved into a different phase, you know? And then in 2020, it moved into a different phase. And at the point that publicly traded companies started buying it and institutions started buying it and mainstream media started coping with it, when the senator got elected, you know, the mayor of Miami Beach, Senator Cynthia Lummis, when these things happen, when Gary Gensler takes his role at the SEC, you're in a different phase. And so you have to recalibrate all your models based upon a whole new set of assumptions. And it's like I took the spear out of your hand, I gave you a bow and arrow. The human race changed. I take your bow and arrow out of your hand, I gave you a gun. I take the gun out of your hand and I give you a bomb. As I change the engineering, the outlook changes and you cannot draw on your history anymore. You have to think differently.
Well, I mean, I obviously agree with a lot of that, but let me push back a little bit in the sense that, you know, Bitcoin has not changed. It's been doing one lock every 10 minutes for the past 12 years throughout all of these phases. And Bitcoin's volatility and market dynamics have not changed much. We've gotten these big bull runs after the halvings every single time. So far, it's extraordinary what has happened in Bitcoin over the last year, but it isn't extraordinary by the standards of Bitcoin. It's happened before. So the question is, will this time be different? Do you think, have we moved into something fundamentally different after 2020, or will we still see a market cycle similar to what we had before?
Bitcoin hasn't changed, but all of the ecosystem around Bitcoin has changed radically. For example, Bitcoin is not just the underlying blockchain. Bitcoin is the banks that are plugged into Bitcoin. So Fidelity is a Bitcoin bank. Coinbase is a Bitcoin bank. Binance didn't exist 4 years ago. It's a Bitcoin bank. The CME is a Bitcoin bank. PayPal and Square are Bitcoin banks. MicroStrategy and Grayscale are Bitcoin banks. Those are radically different things. Probably PayPal and Square will, between the two of them, they will sell Bitcoin to, what do you think, 20, 30 million people this year? The holders of Bitcoin have changed. The investment community have changed. The narrative has changed. The use case has changed. The way that people buy it has changed. And the technology to buy it. For example, I buy $200 million of it. I do with 88,000 transactions every 3 seconds, buying Bitcoin $2,000 a second. And I buy it to hold it forever. That's changed. Look at all the Bitcoin that Grayscale bought. It's locked up in a trust. Do you know how that will be sold?
Not sure, no.
Tell me how, this is a good question for anybody on the call. How do you think that's ever going to be sold?
Yeah, I can't see it getting sold. I see them just accumulating more.
It's actually more extreme than that. It is impossible to sell it, Saifedean. There is no mechanism to sell it. The construction of the trust is such that when the money flows into the trust, they buy Bitcoin. There are GBTC shares that are issued. Those shares can be sold and the price of the shares, the derivatives can go down. The underlying Bitcoin can never be sold per the charter, ever, ever. Well, so you see, there are fundamental different things that are going on. Last I checked, they had $30 billion of Bitcoin. That's $30 billion of Bitcoin that can't be sold. okay, held by institutions, a very, very different world. So these are sources of inertia flowing into Bitcoin. And by the way, the volatility is not the same. Like if you look at the drawdowns, they're not the same. Like when Bitcoin ran up to 40,000, it traded back down to 30,000. That was a 25% retracement, not an 80% retracement.
So you think the days of 80% retracements are over?
Yes, I do. Let me say it a different way. If you're a Boy Scout and you're shivering in the freezing cold and you're attempting to start a fire for the first time, you recall how difficult it is to start a fire, and then you recall going to sleep without a fire, and then maybe your friend froze to death and you're mortified by it. But then one day you grow up and you have a furnace in your house, or maybe you plug into someone else's electrical system and you have an electrical heater. You're not a Boy Scout anymore.
Yeah.
Right? It's a totally different world. And the system, the network is much more mature. It's just much better engineered. There's much more monetary energy in it. There's much more inertia. I mean, ultimately, there's massive amounts of monetary inertia in the system. It's like an air compressor. We're compressing energy in a monetary battery, and it's accelerating if you look at the rate at which energy is flowing into it. And as that energy flows, it's stabilizing. So the more monetary energy flowing in the system, the more stable it is, the more inertia it is, the more difficult it is to change the direction, and the less volatility it has. And I think that you're going to continue to see that as the as these banks evolve. It's very clear to me ever since March, you can literally see the volatility and the instability in the entire network being damped by rational actors.
Let me give you my counter case. I think ultimately, as the more money comes into Bitcoin, the more the price goes up, the problem there is that you start getting more and more Bitcoin minted. So effectively, Bitcoin becomes more inflationary as the price rises. And I think this might be why the halving dynamic always will have a big rise, but also a crash, because over the past 4 years, in the previous halving period, we had 4 years in which we were making on average $7,000 worth of Bitcoin a day. 1,800 Bitcoins worth on average $7,000 or $9,000. So you had about $14 million a day of new Bitcoins being produced. So for the price to hold around that level, we had to have around $14 million of new demand a day. Now, there's only so much more the demand can increase. There will come a point in which the demand goes up, and so the price goes up, and then the price of the new coins that are being mined is also going up massively. And so then the new supply becomes bigger than the demand. The demand can't keep up with the supply. And we witness an inflection because there's also a lot of leverage, a lot of people that are leveraged in, so they get wiped out, and then the technicals of the chart turn. And then we could have another big drawdown. What do you think?
I'm not really a big believer in the halvings as being a driver going forward. Again, I think that all of these models are mental models that were formed in the early years. And I think that you should throw them all out and you should start to reason from first principles and build a new model. For example, I'm staring at the screen of Binance right now. The 24-hour volume of BTC is 93,000 coins on Binance. If you double it, that means there's probably 180,000 coins traded today. 900 Bitcoin is irrelevant. The amount of Bitcoin being created is so de minimis compared to the volume of the trading. It's irrelevant. And also, I think it's irrelevant to any rational investor. It's just irrelevant to me. For example, there's 21 million fully diluted Bitcoins. Done. End of story. Like, I don't care at what rate they get printed, because again, what's the ratio of 93,000 to 900? The amount of Bitcoin getting mined is 50 basis points. It's half of a percent. Like when we're doing a trade, we pay 0.5% as the fee. Like people with serious amounts of money, they're going to blow through this. They don't care. What matters a lot more than all of these concerns about, you know, the halving is if Paul Tudor Jones wakes up and decides to double his allocation from 1% to 2%, or from 2 to 4, that matters more than all of these other things because the demand is excessive. So I think a better way to look at it is it's emerging as an asset class like the S&P 500 index. And when it gets to be $10 trillion or $5 trillion or $3 trillion, it's like the index, there's so much money coming in and going out of it that it's stabilizing the index. And if you've got a $10 trillion asset class like gold, it would take $1 trillion. Why do you think I didn't buy gold? It's because I said, well, it's going to take $20 trillion to drive gold up by a factor of 10. How much does it really take, right? I mean, if you have a $1 trillion asset class, then $1 trillion will probably drive it up by a factor of 10. Like if you double the demand, maybe more. But if you've got a $10 trillion asset class, $1 trillion drives it up by a factor of 2 maybe, or 50%. So as it gets more monetary energy, the inertial component gets greater, the liquidity gets greater. I really think for institutional investors, the halving, it just doesn't matter anymore. The dynamic that matters is, another example, if Dan Schulman wakes up tomorrow and says, I think I should put Bitcoin on PayPal's balance sheet. Dan Schulman has a $300 billion company. He could put $10 billion of Bitcoin on the balance sheet. When Coinbase comes public, they might be worth $100 billion. If the CEO of Coinbase decides to put Bitcoin on their balance sheet, he could put $1 billion on the balance sheet, $2 billion, $3 billion. The decisions of individuals. Ray Dalio is giving a speech at Consensus. Ray Dalio's got $150 billion of assets under management. If he decides that Bitcoin is 25% as good as gold, won't they buy like $10 billion of it? Ray Dalio, Brian Armstrong, Dan Schulman, right? Individuals. There's probably 10,000 people in the world that have the ability to put $1 billion on that network. 10,000. And there's 1,000 or 2,000 have to be able to put $10 billion on the network. Again, every model that you have and all the history that we have is all irrelevant if any of them act. The actors, the actions that get taken place obsolesce and they overwhelm any statistical models because the statistical models are based upon, like if you told me, for example, in 2018, you have a bunch of Bitcoin and crypto traders that are trading with leverage that have no banks, that can't borrow money against their Bitcoin. Okay. Those people have a very short time preference, Saifedean. You're the time guy, right? The people that have the shortest time preference I've found are crypto traders. I mean, they're thinking about whether or not it's trading down in the next 8 hours, right? So when I ask people, why don't you put 100% of your assets into Bitcoin? They say, well, I need money to live on. Well, why don't you just borrow money? Who's going to loan me money? BlockFi, they charge 12%, 10%, right? So there's a very embryonic industry right now. The consumer banking industry that's banking Bitcoin. By the way, name 5 companies that'll give you a $100 million loan against Bitcoin. Name 5. Can you? No. No. It's embryonic. I can name 5 that'll give me a $100 million loan against Apple stock. Citigroup, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Morgan Stanley, everybody. Okay. And here's my point. Bitcoin doesn't need to change. What's changing is the banks. The banks are changing. NYDIG will give you a loan. Genesis will give you a loan. When Coinbase will give you a loan, Binance is rolling out some credit products. PayPal won't give you a loan yet, but what happens when PayPal gives 340 million people a loan at 4% interest against Bitcoin? What happens to Bitcoin? Well, time horizon stretch out. Now I can own it for 30 years. Oh, you mean I don't have to sell my Bitcoin to buy my Lamborghini? If you actually believe Bitcoin's going up by a factor of 2 every 2 years, you're an idiot to sell your Bitcoin to buy your Lamborghini. That Lamborghini is going to cost you $100 million. Why don't you borrow the money to buy the Lamborghini and keep the Bitcoin? Well, I'm afraid. I'm afraid of what? I'm afraid it's going to crash down by 80%. Why? Well, because it did once before. Okay. So you see this circular reasoning, which is I lived in a world of crypto traders on leverage with no banking, with no institutional support. And so I act. It's just like your time preference. I'm afraid to plan for the future because I don't trust the money. Okay. A lot of people in their head, they think Bitcoin is volatile. I don't trust it. I won't be able to borrow against it. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And by there's only a certain amount of rate at which you can change people's perceptions, right? It takes 3, 4, 5, 6 years. As the hodlers discover that they can borrow money against Bitcoin, and as the institutions come in, by the way, what's Warren Buffett's favorite famous quote? We find a company we like, our preferred holding period is forever. Is Warren Buffett still owning Coca-Cola stock? Yes. Did he sell it to buy a Lamborghini? No. Did he need to? No. Why? Because he could have borrowed against it. Yeah. What's the impact on Coke stock? It's not so volatile, right? Because he's a hodler. So this is not it's not an uncommon idea. How long are institutions that hold gold? How long have they been holding gold? Like forever? Like what happens if you replace gold with digital gold? You hold it for 50 years. By the way, I don't think you're going to be able to buy Bitcoin. Bitcoin below 20,000, gone forever. Bitcoin below 30,000, probably gone forever. Bitcoin below 40,000, probably gone forever. Bitcoin in the 40 to 50,000 range, who do you think selling this stuff? The weak hands with high leverage are selling it. Who do you think's buying it? Institutions that have more money than God, that have 1,000 times as much money as they're buying with this stuff. And which ones? The first 1%, just the early vanguard. So as this happens, the institutions take ownership. Their time horizon is a decade. The banks come online. That means we never need to sell it ever. I mean, all these guys on crypto Twitter go, well, what are you going to do if you ever need money? The answer is I'm never going to need money. Like, right? I'm not. Institutions never need money, right? If I ever wanted a little bit of cash, I could just borrow a little bit. But the truth of the matter is the people buying this stuff are endowments, Harvard endowment, Yale endowment, right? I mean, so it's a different set of holders. It's a different banking relationship. It's going to be more diffuse. As it's more diffuse, the volatility falls. You're going to have the stories of Ruffin, Saifedean. Ruffin bought $750 million of Bitcoin below 20,000 when it traded to 40,000. They took half off the table. So they took a $750 million profit. That's why it didn't trade up beyond 40,000. So then it traded down to 31,000. They might have bought back in, Safe. You know, like those guys, the big institutions, you know, they're going to be damping it on the upside and on the downside and collaring it. And this will continue for a while. So it's a different dynamic because of the players and the capital and the banks and the security. And it's going to continue to evolve, and the risk profiles and the perceptions will evolve.
Yeah, and I think also the best argument against this is just, yeah, maybe the mining just becomes completely inconsequential compared to the daily volume. And then in that case, it doesn't even matter if it's...
I would say it's already inconsequential.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's already inconsequential. I think that I think the only people clinging to that are people that like to talk about miners. I mean, I don't think the miners can move the market one way or the other. Let me make one more point. As the miners come public, they have publicly traded stocks. It's irrational for them to ever sell Bitcoin. What did Marathon just did? They bought Bitcoin. If you can raise equity or raise debt in the public market, the miners might stop selling it, because isn't it the stupidest thing you could possibly? Who goes in the mining business thinking Bitcoin is going down in price, right? Nobody. So why would you sell something going up in price by 100 or 200% a year? You wouldn't. What happens, Saifedean, if all the miners come public and they stop selling?
Yeah, I mean, it's like new extra demand. It's supercharged demand because it buys at the source. And
I mean, reverse it a different way. What happens if the miners stop selling and start buying? Marathon raised $200 million in equity and bought $150 million of Bitcoin. Okay? Yeah. So my point here really is there's other dynamics. It's possible that you could have 10 miners come public. They all raise $25 billion. They just all buy and then they mine Bitcoin and keep. And now what happens if I reverse the polarity in the entire situation? The halving doesn't matter, right? There's other things that matter, right? At the end of the day, what's 1,000 Bitcoin at $40,000? What's that net you? $40 million a day or something? $40 million of capital a day is irrelevant compared to $10 million of purchasing a day.
It wouldn't be irrelevant at $400,000 Bitcoin. At $400,000 Bitcoin, that's $400 million of new Bitcoin.
It'll still be irrelevant because the trading of the rest of the marketplace is going to be 100x more than that.
Well, currently, I think Daniel just posted a screenshot saying that current daily trading volume is about 15 billion. So currently, it's at 3%. So if price goes up tenfold, then mining is 30% of the market. And if the market stays constant at around 15 billion. So 3% now, but if the price goes up tenfold, if it's at $480,000, then you know, you're doing about $500 million of new Bitcoin being minted every day, which is a lot of money.
Well, actually, it's not 3% safe. It's 30 basis points. Like that's what I get. 900 coins. Uh-huh. Isn't it 900 a day times 48,000?
Yeah.
You guys can check it. That gives me $43 million a day.
Yeah, 43 divided by 15 billion. That's,
See, it's like, it's not even a percent. It's like a fraction of a percent. It's like it's 25 basis points right now. And my point again is, it's 25 basis points. What's the most profitable investment you can hold on your treasury? Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
Tell me a miner that doesn't believe in Bitcoin. The stupidest thing you can do is sell your Bitcoin. Don't sell your Bitcoin. Okay, so what's going to happen? I actually think you're going to see the polarity flip on this. I think that as miners come public, like Riot and Marathon, I think they're going to think about it and they're going to realize that they should just keep mining but stop selling. Have you looked at Marathon stock? It hit $40 today. It more than doubled since they bought Bitcoin on their balance sheet safe in 2 weeks. You know what the market's telling you? The market's telling you that pretty much they will finance you with a premium to hold the Bitcoin because they like the Bitcoin. So what that means is that in theory, a publicly traded mining company can raise unlimited equity or debt and never sell.
Yeah.
So it's not that big a deal now, but the point really is there are other dynamics here and they could flip the polarity. What happens if $10 billion comes from the public markets into the Bitcoin market because these miners, I think Marathon's got a 3 billion market cap, Riot's got a 3 billion market cap. What happens if they double and they issue debt or issue equity? And my point is, all your models are destroyed. Humility here is there's a lot of people that can tip the apple cart here. So if you construct this model based upon the past, you're dismissing the actions of rational actors. It's rational for a miner to buy Bitcoin, not sell Bitcoin. It's rational for a miner to go public. It's rational for Square or PayPal to buy more Bitcoin. They might not, by the way. It's irrational not to. They might not because of volatility. How do you convince your customers they should buy Bitcoin with your app when you're afraid to buy it on your balance sheet, right? Isn't there a little bit of a marketing hazard there? So there's rational actors with capital that can move this Bitcoin and they can change the volatility and they can drive it very, very hard. And the only thing that keeps them from doing it is getting up in the morning and deciding they'll take a risk. If you basically bet that nobody will act rationally and nobody will take a risk, then you can run your historical models. But if I can break your model, if I break your model with action, right?
Yeah.
Then you probably ought to have a more open-ended view of the world, a different model. I look at it and I say, everybody on earth with money should buy this stuff and all 7.8 billion people need it. and it's only distributed to 0.1% of the market. What's wrong with this picture? At some point, someone is going to decide to do the rational thing. And by the way, arguably, they're doing it now, right? If the price is going up 300% a year, that seems to me to be rational risk takers acting about as fast as they can reasonably act, right? Without, you know, going through the sound barrier. You go through a sound barrier, there's a shock wave, and you rip the wings off the airplane. We're kind of pushing up against the sound barrier, the rate at which what's the fastest an asset class can take on monetary energy without burning itself up. This might be close to the fastest because it's accelerating, isn't it? I mean, weren't we growing like, I haven't seen the numbers. Someone should calculate the annualized yield, but I thought it was 230% IRR or something for the last 5 to 10 years.
The average growth rate per year was about 200 for the first 10 years.
And it's accelerated this year.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it always goes through those cycles so far with fast and then slow and with variability. So yeah, we were due for a very fast year this year anyway. Now look, I mean, as an Austrian economist, I'm always exactly on the same page with you on the fact that it is the actions of humans that determines economic outcomes and not statistical models and constructs. But this year, we've been fascinated a little bit with the stock-to-flow model, and it's it drives me to think that there might be something mechanical about the way that the difficulty adjustment and mining determine how the price moves, just because there's a limit on how much the price can go up over time.
I don't think the stock-to-flow model really can explain what's going on here, because as I said, I immediately assumed it was 21 million diluted Bitcoin, and that's what I made my decision based on. And I assumed that stock to flow is infinite. And I think that a stock to flow doesn't take into account the actions of the fiat central banks to inflate the currency. And clearly, if there was zero inflation versus 400% inflation, that's a factor. You know, Zimbabwe inflation rates are different than the US, and the US is radically different than a year ago. So I think you got to take into account in monetary policy, and I think you got to take into account technology. Stock to flow doesn't take into account what happens if Tim Cook decides to build Bitcoin into the Apple Watch and the Apple phone. Those actions in technology, they have an impact, and doing it sooner rather than later will do it. And I know for a fact there are 10 people in the world. All they would have to do is put out a press release and they would move the price of Bitcoin. And so the technology adoption and the monetary policy, all those things, they have a massive impact on what happens yet. And they're not really part of the stock to flow.
No, they aren't. But I mean, and rationally, this is why you would expect the model to break down, and yet it doesn't. And that's really the mind blowing thing as far as I'm concerned. And I think, you know, it might sound funny to say it, but the model would have expected a big squeeze after the halving. And so, you know, that needed people like you and MassMutual to show up and, you know, carry the banner after we'd done the light lifting. We needed you guys to do the heavy lifting, taking us to 100K. And I think, yeah, 2025 is when we'll expect people like Apple to be building their entire company around something like Bitcoin. It's a little maybe too early for them to start now, but I think maybe by 2025, they'll be sold and they'll be convinced, and that's what's going to take us further. So maybe, you know, the trend undeniably is number go up, but what the model shows is that that number going up happens in spurts after the halving, and then there's a bit of a come down and consolidation after it, that it follows this market pattern. So it seems to be holding up now, and that for me, and which is really sacrilegious as an Austrian economist to be saying this, but it suggests that maybe there is something about the way that the network works that is forcing this. And in fact, if you read Mises, what Mises says is the reason you can't perform economic calculation and make scientific predictions in economics is that economics does not have a constant. There is no constant in economics. In physics, in chemistry, in math, in all of those things, you go back to, well, not in math, in physics and chemistry, you go back to a physical constant that is, you know, personally determined and easy to ascertain, and all of them go back to constants of nature eventually. And so based on that, you're able to make scientific relationship and devise them. And it seems to me that maybe Bitcoin, what the stock-to-flow model is showing us, the ability to perform calculation with human action for the first time with this kind of accuracy, maybe 21 million is Bitcoin, is economics' first constant.
Well, I agree 21 million is an important constant.
Kelly's asking, what do you think in terms of second and third order effects that you look forward to under new post-March 20 paradigm?
Well, I think one effect is like the first 10 years stock to flow and Bitcoin miners selling Bitcoin bootstrapped the network. I think we'll see an inversion. It's possible that all the Bitcoin miners come public and they stop selling any Bitcoin and they start and they become banks of their own. And they start issuing equity and debt to finance the network. And you could actually see a reverse polarity there. As Bitcoin crashes into institutions that are publicly financeable, I think the dynamic changes quite a lot because they have different options to access liquidity. So it's a different network when it's individuals that are unbanked that are in a cash business than it is when it's institutions that are very, very well banked and well financed. I think, the network is moving toward the point where it's just all transaction based. And I think the transaction block sizes will get larger and transaction fees will go up and the network will settle into some equilibrium there as well.
Okay. How do you come to your conclusion about Bitcoin's total addressable market?
I just take all the money in the world and I figure about half of it needs to be allocated to actual collectibles, trophies. If you look at the typical person, everybody owns a set of things, their house, their car, their boat, their trophy assets, you know, that they're going to keep. And those will have monetary value imbued in them. Those are the goods and services or goods and products and whatever. And then there's another chunk, which is just the treasury. Everybody's got a natural treasury and that's capital saved up for the future against uncertainty. I think it's natural that Bitcoin will just continually absorb that treasury energy from endowments, from corporations, from individuals. And my estimate is it feels like it's about half of everything should be treasury and the other half is tangible property. You can estimate it by counting the volume of gold and the total amount in sovereign debt, half of sovereign debt. Maybe you want to give a loan to your government because you love the government. But, you know, my experience is that 90% of the money invested in sovereign debt wasn't because we loved the government. It was as a store of value. And if you look at the S&P, I think people invest in the S&P because they didn't have confidence in their ability to pick stocks. They wanted a store of value. So I think if you added up all the store of value asset classes, you'll probably find yourself getting to a $200 trillion number, you know, plus or minus against $400 or $500 trillion. Depending on how you calculate it. So you kind of conclude it's like 40 or 50%. And it's kind of common sense, right? Half of your money is you want to save as fungible asset. And the other half, you invest in things you love or things you believe in, or you take risk on companies and the like. I think that was pretty obvious back in the day when savings accounts existed. It's just that savings accounts have been destroyed. And so now half people are saving in the stock market.
Yeah. All right, I guess the final question that I wanted to ask you is, when are we going to turn you into a carnivore? How have you not become a carnivore yet? Or are you a carnivore?
I'm a big paleo theorist. So I'm, you know, long before I discovered Bitcoin, I was a paleo enthusiast. And I think that a lot of stuff that comes out of thinking about how Paleolithic man lived for 3 million years, I think is really useful health advice. What did your forebears eat and how did they live 100,000 years ago? I think it's helpful. It's helpful in your fitness routines and your eating routines. I think that 100,000 or 200,000 years ago, people ate lean proteins and they ate low sugar content, maybe nuts, and they didn't eat sugar-laden fruits, and they probably didn't eat highly engineered modern foods. They certainly didn't eat any processed food. So my view is I am pretty much a carnivore. I eat a lot of steak. I eat a lot of chicken and fish. But I think that vegetables and nuts are okay. The keto diet is a pretty good diet. I understand the Salisbury diet, and I studied that. And I think that in the event that you have autoimmune diseases or inflammation or rheumatoid arthritis, I've seen that that's been very effective. And so I can imagine living off of all meat, but I think it's equally reasonable. If you're coming up with a theory of health I think if you start with the question, how did human beings live for 3 million years before the modern agricultural age, and you model your lifestyle based upon that, I think that's consistent with the healthiest lifestyle. And your conclusions are you're probably not going to drink orange juice. You're not going to drink cartons of vodka. You're not going to consume processed foods. You're not going to sit in a chair all day long. You're probably not afraid to be out in the sun. You should probably do vigorous activity. And you should probably eat lean, healthy proteins.
Yeah, well, I'll just tell you the case for carnivore is ultimately that if you try it, you'll see that the difference going from standard American diet to keto is almost comparable to the difference of going from keto to pure carnivore. Just getting rid of all plant matter, and you know, your body's made out of red meat, and if you just eat red meat, your body has and digestive system will have an enormously easy time with it. So I started drinking some cola there. I think if you ate a lot more beef, you would need fewer snacks and fewer pick-me-ups and fewer caffeine things. So we have to get you to join us on the carnivore train as well.
Okay, I take it under advisement.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, Michael, for joining us. This was absolutely mind-blowing and fascinating and lots to chew over. And thank you so much for your time. I really, truly appreciate it.
Okay. You too. Thanks, everybody, for hanging out with us.
Cheers. Take care.
Appreciate it.